On the 15th of September 1830, the Liverpool and Manchester Railway opened as the first passenger-carrying railway in the world. This would trigger the railway age. In London, the capital of the British Empire and Europe's largest city, this would lead to massive changes as the railway companies scrambled to serve the city. However, the city authorities resisted demands to build stations inside the city's central districts, and instead the terminals formed a ring around the city. In 1863, the Metropolitan Railway would trigger the Underground Age, as the first underground passenger railway in the world was opened to connect these terminal stations to the city centre. Today in Rails to Nowhere, we begin looking at the history of London Underground, its origins, and the origins of commuting as its very concept. Hello and welcome to Rails to Nowhere. My name is Simon and as ever I'm joined by Ella.
Hello.
And today we are indeed talking about my dissertation. We're starting a epic 10 episode series. Ella's pulling faces at the idea we might ever get that recorded on my dissertation research into the response of London transport to the emergence of the motor car in the 1930s. So we're drawing on quite a lot of in-depth research that I've done for my MA. We're covering most of the topics that I cover in my actual MA thesis, plus a little bit outside of the scope of what I could fit inside that thesis, just because there's a little bit of background stuff that I took for granted in my thesis, but that's kind of important for us to talk about in this series. This episode specifically doesn't really feature in my MA. It's more sort of the background for those of you who maybe aren't as familiar with London Underground history as I am. So today we're talking about the growth of the Underground, its emergence from the mid-1800s, and how it impacts the city a little bit in the late 19th century to sort of set the stage, because we're mostly, this series is going to be talking about the 1920s and 30s, but we need to understand this sort of first 50 years of the Underground, which are going to fly through today.
It's probably worth at this point pointing out that today the tube only refers to the London Underground lines. They are the ones that appear on the tube map themselves and generally are not done as two parallel lines. These are the solid ones. Yeah. There are other things on what we would now call the tube map, but the tube, at least as we're going to be discussing it, will only refer to these original lines and original companies, not extra systems like the DLR, Overground, Thameslink.
Yeah.
And other systems that have been added on. Even though a lot of people do refer to these other systems as part of, quote, the tube, they are not going to be referred to as part of this.
We're talking pretty much anything that was on the tube map sort of pre-2000, excluding the DLR, which I know was on the tube map by that point. So I said that this was what I'd studied for my MA thesis, which means that this is something I've looked at in detail, and part of the detailed research I've had to do is justify why it is I would talk about this, why this is something we need to talk about. That's something you have to do with any sort of study like this. You have to think about, well, why is this a relevant topic of study? And I think it's quite an important bit of discussion because we're really talking about undoing a lot of what happened in the 1920s and 30s, or what started in the 1920s and 30s right now. We've got things like low traffic neighbourhoods, 15-minute cities, all of that sort of in the news right now, and that's the sort of stuff that begins to disappear in the 1930s, because driving everywhere is not the default state for urban transport for the vast majority of cities' existences.
No, it's important to remember the motor car has been only around in public accessibility since really the end of the First World War as a thing that most people can actually purchase and access as a form of transport. Prior to this, yes, they did exist, but it was generally reserved for very well-off people rather than what we would now describe as an average middle-class person. Because don't forget, those are the main targets of a system like the Underground as well, not your working-class people who are working manual jobs. These are people who are commuting in and doing that sort of work.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the motor car in a later episode. But yeah, they generally don't exist. Hmm. They come into existence, actually, interestingly, the first motor cars come into existence broadly the same time as the railways are first developing, but they don't become marketable to many people until post-First World War. Obviously, we always like to throw around the Ford Model T as the turning point. It's actually much more complicated than just the Model T appears, which we'll talk about in a later episode. But that's the good sort of benchmark. It's the early 1920s where it really begins to take off. We're also in kind of a significant year for talking about London underground history, railway history generally, ownership of railways, because we're 160 years from when London Underground first opened. So the Metropolitan Railway opens in 1863, which is 160 years ago this year. We are on the anniversary of the foundation of London Transport in 1933 as well. So that's 90 years ago that the London Passenger Transport Act is passed and London Transport comes into being. We're also the anniversary of the foundation of the Big Four and British Rail.
Yep.
So it's kind of pertinent to be talking about railway ownership, nationalisation, because London Transport goes from being private companies before 1933 to what we term a quango today, I guess, in 1933. It's an interesting organisational structure, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a slightly later episode when we get to talking about the passage of the London Passenger Transport Act. And we're also in the midst of the attempts to form or discussions about the formation of Great British Railways, which is the potential next iteration of mainline operations. So I think it's really interesting to be talking about how urban transport's developed, what's some of the thinking that's happened in the past regards ownership, nationalisation, all of that sort of stuff, and sort of moving the conversation forward by looking at how we've ended up where we have.
It's very much a good time to be thinking about how we conceive of transport as well. Obviously, with all the environmental concerns that are going on, as well as systems like HS2 also being built, it's certainly worth thinking how we consider transport from every single level, because what we currently have is generally believed to be unsustainable.
Yeah, so it's very important that we're sort of thinking about the future, but as we discuss in our historiography bonus episode, you can't really think about the future without understanding the past, which, on that note, we should talk a little bit about the literature that kind of exists. We're not going to do a full-on literature review for the topic. We'll talk a little bit more about the literature that does and doesn't exist and the strengths and weaknesses of it as we go through. I thought about having this episode as basically being my introduction to my dissertation and sort of have a full-on 2,000-word literature review, and I thought that might not sit so well with our audience. It's probably a little heavier, too academic for what we're trying to do here. But we'll have a sort of overview and we'll talk a little bit more about stuff as it crops up as we go through the series.
And to the academics listening, if you do want the heavy, heavy details, check the notes. There's stuff in the notes.
Yep.
And also hop on the Patreon. There will be things on there, obviously.
Yep. And you can email us at contact@railstonowhere.co.uk. I'll put that in the notes as well if you want to get a more detailed list of the sources I used for my dissertation. So London Transport, like British Rail, like a lot of railway history, it's got a lot written on it. London Transport specifically has loads of stuff written on it, but a lot of it falls into two categories. You've either got technical stuff written about it. So you've got things written about how trains work and how the underground functions, how train stops work. We talked about train stops in our last episode, how the electrical system functions and all of that, which is all well and good, but it doesn't really give us any sort of analytics on the history. It's just sort of giving us facts and figures of when lines open, how the technical stuff functions. And you've also got a lot of sort of descriptive history. So you've got books like Rails Through the Clay by Alan Jackson, which is basically just here's a list of when everything's happened. And those, don't get me wrong, those are useful, they have their place. But again, they're not giving us the analytics. That's where the vast majority of writing on London transport history exists. Partially because it is designed for a sort of more consumer audience and a general interest history, which is fine. That has its place within the discourse. But what London Underground history and London Transport history more widely sometimes suffers from is our lack of analytical history and sort of tying it together with the exterior forces that are going on. In our last series on technology, I'm always talking about politics and the exterior forces that are occurring, and we're going to cover that again a bit in this because it's important to understand how the railway is placed within the world.
Yes, these systems are not isolated systems. The world is not a series of isolated machines.
Yeah.
And by placing these things into the wider context, hopefully, hopefully we're giving people a bit more of an understanding of how they worked, why they worked, why they didn't work, and potentially where we might be able to take them in the future.
Yeah, and the other limitation on a lot of London transport history is that it is often mode specific. So you get histories on the underground, or even in some cases on a specific company. One of the most recent really good texts that's come out on London underground history is Mike Horn's two-part history of the District Railway, but that's taking it really to like one line, one company level. Or you get things like Alan Jackson's Rail Through the Clay, which is talking about the underground, or there's a host of books on buses and trams, but very rarely do you get discussions where somebody's talking about all of the modes and sort of the overarching history of transport overall in London.
And also the wider context around the transport in London too.
Yeah.
We're missing a lot of the other interests of organisations like London Transport, the London Passenger Transport Board and British Rail and so on, because I think most of the text written on this topic is written for people who have an interest in railways and not so much the wider picture that maybe is worth looking at for these companies.
Yeah, so this series is bringing things together to sort of look at the different modes, look at the exterior forces and think about how London Transport is operating within the broader picture. One of the other big things that's often missing from discussions of transport generally in Britain in the 1920s and 30s is discussion of the impact of the motor car. Now, way back in episode one, we talk about the impact of motor lorries on goods transport, but very often we discount discussion of the motor car and its impact on personal transport in this era. The narrative generally is considered to be the motor car takes off in the States in this period. The general narrative is not often that the motor car takes off in the UK in this period. It just sort of magically appears in the 1950s. The problem is that's not true. The motor car doesn't just appear out of nowhere post-World War.
No.
I'm not suggesting that the motor car is a mass means of transport in the 1930s, but if we look at archive footage of London specifically in this era, we can see that there are actually quite a lot of cars on the roads.
Mm.
Examining records of London transport, I note that congestion and making priority for motor cars is on the minds of London transport in this period. So they are acting in response to it. So to just discount it as a force within how London transport is developing in this period is doing a disservice to our understanding of the city's development.
It's also worth remembering it's not a uniform adoption across the country or even across the city.
Yes.
And you go to various parts of the British Isles here. The car is adopted across it in various different amounts by various different groups.
Yep.
We see islands like Jersey and Guernsey adopt it a lot more heavily at this time as compared to mainland Britain. I've been looking at some stuff to do with various people out on Jersey, and it's notable that all are starting to complain about their increased levels of motor cars here. There's increased problem with speed as a problem. There's competition between various groups because of the motor car. And also notable how it, when the islands get occupied by the Germans in the Second World War, there's a really interesting issue where the Germans requisition basically all motor cars and everyone has to work out how to travel without the motor car. But this is in contrast to a lot of the UK where the adoption is a lot slower for various different reasons.
It is important to note that we're looking at London, which in mainland Britain is where the concentration of motor vehicles are. I don't have the figures directly in front of me because they're in the script for I think episode 2 or 3 of this series, but the majority of motor vehicle registrations in the UK are within the Greater London area. So the motor car is having a greater impact in London than it does in other areas at this time, but it's still a good point to sort of look at how policy ideas and thinking are developing in this period. As a result, this series and my dissertation draw heavily on a couple of important texts for the sort of foundation of a lot of the argumentation on the motor car. So I'm going to throw in a couple of key texts that I've discussed. So these are Michael John Law's two papers, The Car Indispensable and The Experience of Suburban Mobility. These talk about the hidden impact of the motor car that's occurring in London in this period and sort of how that's actually much greater than a lot of the other texts talk about. We've also got Peter Scott's The Making of the Modern British Home, which sort of talks about changes in housing preference, housing design, the growth of the semi-detached house, but also actually the growing ability of the upper working class and the lower middle class to access suburban life in this period, because we again often sort of think about suburbia as being a middle class thing, and that's often how it's portrayed in the 1950s, because it's portrayed as a way of bettering yourself. But actually in the 1920s and 30s we find a lot more access to these slightly nicer ways of living for a lot of people in this period. So we're going to be talking about how this era lays the ground for the post-war shift to the motor car and the era of the motorway in the 1950s and 60s. Something which I argue would happen in the late 1940s, early 1950s, if it wasn't for the Second World War, and that the Second World War just pushes that back by sort of 10, 15 years until the money becomes available again to make that able to happen. Additionally, we're going to be looking at a couple of places where there really are gaps in how we interpret London transport history for this period, and that's notably relating to advertising. Now, don't get me wrong, London transport advertising is written about quite extensively. People like the posters, but one of the things that isn't really talked about or isn't analysed is how motor car advertising is impacting general railway advertising and specifically London transport advertising in this period. And actually, if you compare the sort of adverts that are coming out for the motor car industry and the sort of adverts coming out for the railways in this period, there are some strong parallels. Now, some of those are down to the new Art Deco art styles and new tastes, but actually it's very under-talked about how these different tastes and the appeal of the motor car is actually causing the railways to have to change their advertising style. And we'll talk about that later on in the series. So that's sort of the background of this topic, why it's important, where we fit into the narrative and the general historiography for the history of the underground. So let's talk a little bit about the background of where the underground comes from, why it's built, and some of the impact it has on London as a city in the late 19th and early 20th century. We're going to go up to about the start of the First World War, because generally World War One forms a sort of boundary in a lot of railway history and as well in London Underground history. There's a lot of ownership changes in the late 1910s, so it's a useful boundary to sort of use between sort of early London Underground history and mid London Underground history, really.
The first passenger carrying railway was the Liverpool and Manchester Railway, first opening in 1826 and carrying passengers between Liverpool and Manchester.
They're really imaginatively named, these Victorian railways, aren't they?
I know. This ushered in a major change in the attitude of how railways would work and what they were conceived to be used for. Priorly, they had only been conceived as a goods-carrying system and mostly for short distances in and around localities. But now they're seen as a long-distance means of transport and for carrying valuable cargo, namely people.
Yeah.
It's important to note this didn't lack a lot of modern things we would ascribe to railways now. For example, there was no such thing as signalling. Instead, trains were very much regulated off the principle of the policeman, who would have a watch and time of departures and just would hope that the prior train had cleared the section in front of them. It's also railway with the first major accident that gets reported on, but I'm sure you've all heard that story time and time again.
Yeah, so we get our passenger carrying railways, and in 1836, the passenger railway comes to London. So it's 20 years after the Liverpool and Manchester. We get the London and Greenwich Railway, which runs from Spa Road, which is just down the line from London Bridge Station, out to Greenwich. And this is often ascribed as the first commuter railway. And I would argue that it is. It's kind of the first one designed to take people from a nearby town or village to a city centre, certainly in the UK and arguably the world. And this is really a new concept, this idea that not only is the railway for intercity travel, but that it's actually for local travel as well. This is an interesting thing with a lot of the sort of very early railways, is you find stations are actually not very near intermediate towns, because the idea is you go from one big place to the next big place and you don't stop in the middle places for a little while, and then they start adding the stations in the middle. So if you go on like the West Coast Main Line between London and Birmingham, you get a lot of places like Leighton Buzzard and Cheddington where the station is not very near the town centre or the town or the historic town, because the railway didn't originally stop there. It just went from London to Birmingham, and then later they've added the infill stations on the nearest bit of railway to wherever the population centre was. But the arrival of the idea of suburban commuting by railway really ushers in a revolution in urban transport and how people travel around cities. Journeys that previously would have taken hours by stagecoach or horse and cart suddenly take 30, 40 minutes by train. And it really ushers in this idea that you can work in the city centre and live in a town out of the city centre. And again, this is very early on. It's a thing that richer middle-class clerks and clerical staff can access as sort of the base level of people who can access this, and higher-ups can obviously access this sort of service. But very quickly, the railways begin spreading out from major urban areas such as London, such as Manchester, such as Liverpool. And very early on, they're required to offer something called workman tickets, which means they have to offer a cheap rate, usually before about 7 a.m, for anyone who's a labourer and going into town to work in like the docks or the factories or whatever the labour of that city may be. And this begins to open up this idea of commuting to a much greater number of people. It's important to note that commuting isn't created as a concept by the railways. It previously existed. You've got people walking huge distances in a lot of places to get to work. And a lot of places get trams or horse buses before they get a railway. And that creates a sort of commuting area in those spaces. But the railways really expand the areas that commuting can occur from. London could never have reached the size that it has if it wasn't for sort of the ability to commute by railway.
Yeah. If you would like to see good examples of early commuter systems, commuter towns, a good place to look is actually the eastern seaboard of America. In a place like New York, you'll see various neighborhoods that were built up around the idea of what they call the streetcar, and then, which was obviously stopped quite frequently and often were horse-drawn or cable-hauled. Then the idea of then you see other boroughs popping up around railway stations, on the subway, and later on also the intercity lines in and out of the city.
Yep.
And you can see all these different neighborhoods pop up. And in general, what you can see, especially with the streetcar suburbs, as they're called, in general, is about a 10-minute walking radius between each station and in that area. And that kind of gives you an idea of just about how far the average person would be willing to walk to access this service.
And you see that a lot on sort of places like the Southern Railway, where you get a high density of mainline stations in South London, because that's a railway that is being built for the idea of commuting. So London and a lot of cities see a spider web of intercity and inner city railways begin to develop, but this causes some problems for some of the larger cities. London's not alone in this. You've got places like Liverpool and Manchester and Glasgow that also have this same problem, which is you have multiple railway companies who don't get along serving the city centre, which leaves you with multiple termini stations in the city centre. The problem London has is that it is already at the start of the Industrial Revolution much bigger than any of those other places were. It is, I think, the biggest city in Europe at the start of the Industrial Revolution, certainly one of the biggest cities in Europe. So it's already a much bigger space than any of the other cities in the UK. And the City of London authorities do not permit the construction of any surface level railways into the historic centre of London in this era. That's for a variety of reasons, but the net result of that is that you end up with this ring of railway stations around the perimeter of central London. We're talking at this point of stations such as King's Cross, Euston, Paddington, and at the time, Bishopsgate out in the east. These all form a ring around London, mostly along the Euston Road or the various roads that offshoot from it. Euston Road being laid out deliberately to become a major thoroughfare to connect these stations together.
Which it still is to this day.
Yeah, but the problem with this is it means you turn up at London, and if you're at King's Cross, you're a little way out of the city, and if you're at Paddington, you're a really long way out of the financial district of London. Still to this day, Paddington has people who argue that it isn't a central London terminus because it's so far west.
Yeah, made better by Crossrail, but still, it's an incredibly inconvenient station to access.
So enters a gentleman called Charles Pearson, and he proposes the idea of building a below-ground passenger railway, a metropolitan railway, if you might. And He proposes that this should run from Paddington out in the west and should run through to the City of London. And he gets backing from the Great Western Railway financially. It's a little bit unclear. Some of the history suggests maybe the Great Western thought they were going to be able to take it over, or that they were just wanting their trains to run over it. But in 1863, it's been built, it's been dug, it's been constructed, and it opens, initially running with Great Western trains running through it, built to dual gauge. So you've got Brunel 7-foot gauge and standard Stevenson gauge in these tunnels, which to this day means you've got some very wide tunnels on this northern section of the Metropolitan line.
We'll have a cursed railway.
I love the early pictures, because you think like maybe it's Victorians not getting perspective quite right and they've drawn really wide locomotives, but you realize actually no, it just is really wide locomotives.
It's just a really wide locomotive.
Broad gauge trains look so weird. And this is really a game changer. It's the first urban underground railway in the world. This is why underground railways are called metros, because it comes from the Metropolitan Railway.
It's important to note railways have had tunnels and so on to this point, but this is the first railway deliberately constructed to go under the ground and run basically its entire length underground.
Yeah, and specifically within a city. So it's less intrusive than the surface level railways, which gets it the ability for the City of London to give it the authority to go into the City of London, although it initially only terminates at Farringdon Street, which is actually a little bit short of the present day Farringdon Station. And if you're familiar with where Farringdon Station is, it's only just on the limits of the City of London. So they're still a little hesitant initially.
It's also quite disruptive to build at this time because construction methods are very basic. This is the classic cut and cover method. For those who don't know, you dig a hole, you put your train down, you build an arch over it, you cover up the arch and the train.
Yeah, so this is why this early section of the Metropolitan Railway follows Euston Road, because it's built down the middle of Euston Road, because you've got a nice big wide road, you don't need to buy any buildings, you don't need to knock them down, etc., etc. This leads to a massive proposal for railways across London, including a proposal for a circular railway, known now as the Circle Line, for which the Metropolitan Railway founds its own company, the Metropolitan District Railway, to help construct the southern half. We'll get back to the MDR slightly later. Hello, Simon here. Sorry for the brief interruption to the conversation. Just a quick shout out to say thank you to our fantastic patrons over at patreon.com/rails2nowhere. Our patrons help support the creation of Rails to Nowhere, contributing as little as just £2 per month to help fund the various costs that come with running even a small podcast like this one. In return, as a thank you for your generous support, me and Ella give you additional bonus episodes, a week's early listen to all of our normal episodes, and some extra early content and some extra content blogs. Otherwise, thank you for listening. Thank you to those of you who do support us. Thank you to those of you who are now thinking about supporting us. And let's return back to the conversation. But as Ella says, the cut and cover method is messy, it's disruptive, it gets in the way. And it does limit still where the railways can go, because you kind of have to follow the roads if you're not wanting to demolish buildings. It limits what curves you can do. And the authorities in places like Westminster and the City of London are still very resistant to this coming in and disrupting all the roads in the centre of London. It's trying to get rid of congestion, but you're not going to do that particularly well if in doing so you have to sort of dig up all the roads in the interim. So you get a gentleman called Mark Isambard Brunel, who constructs a revolutionary tunnel under the Thames called the Thames Tunnel. This is out between Wapping and Rotherhithe, and this is constructed using a tunnelling shield. This is an advancement on mining technology and mining techniques. And what it does is it creates an arch of steel or metal in which your miners can stand while they dig out the London clay, and then behind they can construct the tunnel behind this metal shield, and it gives them a safe place to work. Now, don't get me wrong, the Thames Tunnel is not a safe place to be working. There are several collapses and the system floods and the company goes bankrupt almost immediately, and it is a financial disaster.
You also have issues of decompression sickness and all sorts of other things that weren't fully understood at this point, because it's very much prototype.
This is both an early deep bore tunnel and the first time someone's tried digging under a river, because that's what's prompted this new technology for the construction. Is you can't cut and cover under a river, so how do we build a tunnel under a river? But this technology is then taken by a gentleman called James Henry Greathead, who's a South African engineer, who develops it further, comes up with some improvements to the design, and creates what we know now as the Greathead Shield. And this is the tool that enables the tube to appear. And it's very important that this is the tool that lets the tube appear, because this is a round tunneling shield, about 8 foot in diameter, and it creates circular tunnels. And this is used to create the City and South London Railway. This, as with all of our imaginatively named Victorian railways, runs from the City of London to South London. It runs from King William Street, which is near modern day Monument Station, down to Stockwell Station.
King William Street is the street which runs between Bank Junction and where Monument Station is in the present day, for those who do not know London. And that's by the Bank of England, the big round one where Stormzy did, I forget the song.
Yeah, for those of you who've been following London Underground news recently, it's the road that runs down the side of the new Bank Station entrance.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first tube railway. It is the first deep underground railway. And it is the world's first major railway to use electricity. Now, that's a key point, because it was designed to be cable hauled, and that causes them some problems. We're not going to go into too much detail on that. But there are some serious changes to the plans, because initially it's going to be cable hauled. Then they embrace this new technology, electricity.
I have a quick point on tunnels as well. If you look at the what is now the East London Line on London Overground, that currently uses the old Thames Tunnel dug by Brunel, and to give an idea of the difference between the Brunel tunnelling shield and the Greathead shield, you can see that the massive difference in scale of the trains in them. The East London Line is mostly to what we would call normal British loading gauge, whereas if you look at any tube train and tube tunnel, it's a lot smaller. You're not fitting a normal train through there.
No.
And it's why tube trains have their iconic, very weird round shape.
Yeah. So the CSLR is massively important for the development of the London Underground and metros and underground railways around the world, because it proves the concept that you can build a railway deep underground and that you can run it off electricity and that people will use it. And so this gives a massive boom to proposals for underground railways. But it's also the first time that an underground railway in London has been proposed to run to the suburbs. Like, its purpose is to link the centre of London to the suburbs of South London. The Metropolitan Railway, as we say, it's running from Paddington to Farringdon. It's designed to connect the mainline termini to the city centre, but it's not itself running into suburbs yet. They do begin proposing things like the St John's Wood and Baker Street Railway, and proposals to go up to a sort of Harrow Way to connect up to suburbs. But the city in South London is the first attempt to connect the suburbs to the centre of London by the new fledgling underground. So this prompts new thoughts about how the London Underground develops, and so you get the Metropolitan Railway begin to propose extensions out into the fledgling suburban northwest in what they would in the 1920s come to term Metroland. And we'll talk more about Metroland in later episodes. But this is really a massive push by them, although they are weird because their chairman, Edward Watkin, is trying to push them to become a mainline company. We'll talk a little bit about this in a slightly later episodes, because this is one of the principal reasons that the Underground is not included in the grouping of 1921, which we talked about way back in episode one. But they're trying to build a railway out towards Birmingham. Edward Watkin has some mad ideas. He wants to connect Birmingham to Paris through the Metropolitan Railway. It's really interesting history if you want to read up on it. But this means the MR is pushing out towards places like Harrow and Brickmansworth, and this puts them in a very unique position because, like all railways, they have to get an Act of Parliament to be constructed. They have to purchase land, they have to negotiate with landowners, and they have to build their railway on that land. But most railways, their enabling legislation says you can buy a strip of land that's 100 metres wide. You then build your railway that's, say, only 10, 15 metres wide. You build your stations, and then you have to return all the excess land back to whomever you purchased it from. So you have to sell it back to the person who you bought it from for a fair price. The Metropolitan Railway isn't required to do that in a lot of places. It actually has provisions that allow it to hold on to that land. That land is now just the Metropolitan's. So they begin a whole new phase of suburban development in London, which, as I say, they call Metroland, and this is where they buy the land, they build the railway, and then they either directly or indirectly through subcontractors and so on build housing on the excess land they have. So they found new villages, they found new suburbs, they found their own market, so to speak. The idea being you create railway suburbs that are dependent on the Metropolitan Railway for getting into London, so you create a captive market. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in slightly later episodes, but it's important to note that that's a different and unique aspect to the development of the Metropolitan Railway, and it's really one of the reasons why they're able to push so far out, and a principal reason why they do try pushing so far out, because it's that dual aim of trying to get to Birmingham, but also being able to develop their own suburbs, so it gives them the sort of market and the income to be able to afford that. But the Metropolitan Railway goes stupidly far out, because they go all the way out to Aylesbury and beyond. They go up to places like Brill and Verney Junction, which are almost out in Oxford. They go really far out.
It is also important to note, this isn't just the Metropolitan Railway who'd come up with this idea. Again, in America, you see along a lot of, again, the East Coast railway lines building these suburbs and these towns, what are called railway towns.
Yep, and streetcar suburbs.
Yep, they're entirely built around the idea that you can get the train into work at, say, New York or Washington or Boston, and then go home to your house out in the suburbs. You can also look at maps and see that if you follow a railway line, there'll be a town, then a bit of nothing, then a town, and on average, they're about every 10 to 15 minutes of travel time, allowing for a train to cover most of the distance in about an hour and a half, 2 hours, but then stop at all the places along the way and get people in and out of the main urban core. There's also massive advertising at this time through the use of picturesque scenes and things like that.
And we'll talk a bit about that again when we talk about advertising.
But it's all about driving demand, driving people to become dependent on your railway.
Yep. And selling a lifestyle.
Which, yes, you could argue it's a bit like influencer lifestyles today. It's this whole idea that you can do it.
In fact, I will argue that in a couple of episodes' time.
You're welcome.
But yeah, you mentioned American railway suburbs and streetcar suburbs, which...
they're good examples. Yeah,
because you must have been reading the script, because this is the point where I introduce...
You're saying I don't read the script.
Our villain of the story, Charles Tyson Yerkes, who is a very interesting gentleman, and we will be talking more about him in an upcoming bonus episode. But the summary of Yerkes is that he is so corrupt he gets driven out of Chicago in the early 1900s, which is quite an achievement. But he had made his fortune investing in Philadelphia. He had lost his fortune investing in the Reading and Ohio Railroad in the late 1800s, and he had then remade his fortune building streetcars in Chicago. And the story about how he comes to be in London is a little bit murky. It's not especially clear exactly why he decides to come to London per se, but he is enticed to London, most likely by an associate in some of the financial institutions to which he's connected, to come and help electrify the District Railway, who are looking for investors to build electrification infrastructure for them.
Either way, he turns up.
Yeah, Yerkes turns up, and he doesn't stop there. He starts by forming an organization called the Underground Electric Railways of London, which he uses as a vehicle to purchase up a variety of proposals, because I mentioned that the city in South London leads to a multitude of proposals for underground railways. The problem is underground railways are quite expensive to build, and there's what's called railway mania in the 1800s. This is where the railways first start, and then you get big boom in proposals and lots of money's poured into them. People speculate on the railways, and then there's actually quite a big crash as a lot of those railways prove not to be as profitable as they are expected to be. And a lot of underground railways go through a similar process, that there's a big underground mania, there's people pouring money into them, but a lot of them fail to get enough money to be built or parliamentary approval. So after the city in South London opens in 1890, there are only two other underground railways constructed, or tube railways constructed, before the end of the century. So you have the Waterloo and City Railway, which opens shortly after the city in South London. That's sponsored by the London and South Western Railway. It's their connection from Bank to Waterloo. And you have the Central London Railway, which opens in 1900, which runs east-west from Bank to Shepherd's Bush. But you get loads of railway proposals which can't raise enough finance. So Yerkes comes in and he buys up 4 railway proposals. These are the Charing Cross, Euston and Hampstead Railway, the Great Northern and Strand Railway, the Brompton Road and Piccadilly Circus Railway, and the Baker Street and Waterloo Railway. He also ends up buying the Metropolitan District Railway and integrates them all into the Underground Electric Railways of London and the Metropolitan District Electric Traction Company, which are designed to bring these schemes together and electrify the railways. These proposals that he buys up, he forms into 3 tube railways. So he connects the Great Northern and Strand and the Brompton Road and Piccadilly Circus Railways together into the Great Northern, Piccadilly and Brompton Railway. He pushes for the Charing Cross, Euston and Hampstead Railway to go even further than it had initially been proposed. So it had initially been proposed to go from Charing Cross up through Euston, Camden Town, and out towards places like Hampstead. He pushes it even further out towards Highgate and towards Golders Green, because he has built streetcars out to new streetcar suburbs in Chicago, and he sees this as a way of creating new railway suburbs in London that will be dependent on his railway to bring in money, because that's what he's after.
It's a tried and true method, may as well try it.
And these all open in a big bang between late 1906 and early 1907. All these railways open and they form the Bakerloo, Piccadilly and Hampstead Tubes, as they are known at the time. And this is really the first network of lines in London, because you've got the Metropolitan Railway, which is an independent company. You've got the City and South London Railway, which is an independent company. Same with the Central London. They're all independent companies running their own lines. The UERL, or the Underground Group, is the first network. They're technically still independent companies. You technically still need your separate ticket for the Bakerloo Tube and the Piccadilly Tube, but they're a network. They are owned by the same people and they have a joint identity. So if you've ever traveled around London and seen sort of red underground stations from the sort of 1900s, they've got dark red tiles on the front and arched windows. These are Underground Group stations. They're designed by an architect called Leslie Green. We'll talk a little bit more about this in a slightly later episode, but he's commissioned to design the stations for the Underground Group. He designs a standard template of station that is built across 46 locations, providing a network identity to the Underground Group. So much so that even to this day, it's basically a Leslie Green station. It's the byword for a 1900s underground station. There's recently a production being filmed in Greenwich that built a tube station to be designed for during the war, and they use a Leslie Green frontage because that's just your byword, early underground station.
Yep. And to this day, I think a lot of people will recognise that red tiling and the particular arches as one of the many iconic stars of the Underground.
Yeah.
And to the point where I think you look at people when they come for London and they spot one of those, they go, I know what that is. That'll be an Underground station, yeah, without even knowing that it's the Underground, because it's a station design that I think has it's surpassed what it was originally intended to be.
And Yerkes is really keen on electrifying these railways, using modern technology, capitalising on what's known as the Sparks effect. So the idea that modern technology, in this case electricity, therefore the sparks of electricity, draws people to this modern technology. And this is going to be a running theme we talk about through this series, because this is one of the big impacts the motor car will have in later decades. So he pushes for that. He pushes for electrification of the district railway. It is his Metropolitan District Electric Traction Company that pushes for the 4-rail electrification system that the London Underground uses. The Metropolitan Railway initially actually were looking at potentially having overhead electrification for their scheme and a couple of other schemes.
They could probably do it. They had the tunnel.
Yeah. One of the big things that Yerkes does is he puts a kick up the arse of a lot of British railway establishment. His American management style is very different, and his company is run very differently to a lot of UK railways. Dr. David Turner talks about how there was a malaise in UK railway management in this period. A lot of texts talk about this as well, because there's a lot of internal promotion. And don't get me wrong, internal promotion is not per se a bad thing, but pretty much all of the managers in a lot of railway companies were just internal employees, which means there's a lot of sort of stagnation in development and ideas of what's going to be done. Again, in our BR Tech series, we kind of talk about that because you get some stagnation towards the beginning. It's only when they look externally at the airline industry, you get sort of radical ideas like the APT. And you get the same here. Like a lot of the management are just looking at what's been done before and they're just wanting to build on that. And then Yerkes comes in. He says, no, we're going to do these electric trains. We're going to borrow this technology, the electric trains from the States. He also doesn't have the same hang up of buy British that a lot of British railway companies do at this time. And he just goes, well, these companies in the US, Westinghouse and whatever, they know how to do electrification. This company in Germany is really good at building electric components. So he just buys the best equipment from where he can find it because he's not so concerned about just buy British, where a lot of electric component companies are a lot more fledgling. So he purchases German equipment, he purchases American equipment.
He's the reason why a lot of trains from this period, the actual physical trains, look very American in their styling with the classic, I forget the style of roof it is, but you look at a standard stock train, clerestory roof, I think is, I don't know. People correct us. It's a very common style of train design in America and also on the continent, and he imports it because he sees it as the technology and the future.
And he commissions a lot of American carriage builders to sort of design and style these trains, so they just design and style what they are. This is one of the reasons why London Underground has a lot of American terminology in it. So we now use the word bogie, which is the British term, but we used to use the word truck for the wheel sets on the trains. We still refer to cars on London Underground instead of carriages.
And it's also where the Westinghouse brake comes over, because it's an American technology, an American company, Westinghouse, but because we've got an American who's not worrying about buying British, he's very willing to go over and just buy what he sees to be the good thing.
And Yerkes' company, with its new attitude to promotion, looks for a wider range of managers and a wider range of people that could run the railway than the traditional hiring hierarchy for them. And notably, towards the start of the 1910s, the Underground Group is looking for a new general manager, and they pick an American-British businessman called Albert Stanley. And we will talk a little bit more about him in a slightly later episode, because he is a very important person and he really drives a lot of the story of London Underground through this era. And he will appoint to a variety of important positions within London Underground a gentleman called Frank Pick, who again we will talk about in future episodes. But the Underground Group is a really important part of the history of the Underground. It will play a massive role in the next few episodes as we talk about the 1920s and going into the 1930s. And it's really the first point where we get an umbrella organisation running transport in London. But that really brings us to the end of today's discussion of the background of London Underground history. We've covered a good range of stuff. We've covered the historiography. We've talked about the scope of this project, about where we're going, what we're trying to understand. But we've also seen how the Underground's developed from some first nervous holes in the ground through some quite radical technological shifts, bearing in mind that by 1900, there's still only a handful of electric railways that exist in the world and the UK. When the UERL opens all its lines, there's really only the London Underground and the Liverpool Overhead Railway as the only principal electric railways in the UK. So it's radical technological shifts that we've seen in this sort of first 50 years of existence. And we're really going to see, as we go through the 1920s and into the 30s, real changes in how the network's functioning and how it's developing. In the next episode, we're going to be talking about the passage of the London Passenger Transport Act, which creates the London Transport Board in the 1930s. And then we're going to be going on and talking about the development of the motor car and various other aspects as we go through. We've got a bonus episode coming in a few weeks' time, which will talk about Charles Tyson and Yerkes in a bit more detail. If you want to listen to that, you're going to need to subscribe to our Patreon over at patreon.com/rails2nowhere. Big thank you to our patrons, especially our £10 patron, Valkyria Lemons. But yes, so thank you for listening. We shall see you next time. Well, we won't see you, but you shall hear us. Thanks for listening. So until the next time, I've been Simon. She's been Ella. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
This episode of Rouse Nowhere was presented and produced by Simon Sardis & Co. and Eleanor Ashton. Principal research and script writing was carried out by myself, with contributions from Eleanor. All sources are listed in the script. Rails to Nowhere is brought to you by our fantastic patrons over at patreon.com/RailsToNowhere, especially our £10 and above patron, Valkyrie Lemons. Without their support, Rails to Nowhere couldn't happen, and if you'd like to help keep this podcast on the rails for as little as £2 per month, then you can do so over at patreon.com/RailsToNowhere. Until next time, thank you for listening, and have a good day.